Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Business Movers ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. It's fall 1976 at the offices of John Brown & Partners, an advertising firm in Seattle. Phil Knight enters a sleek meeting room. Waiting for him inside is the agency's founder, John Brown. John rises and shakes Phil's hand.
Phil, thanks for coming.
Well, thanks for having me, John.
Have a seat, please.
As Phil takes his seat opposite John, he is cautious but hopeful. Phil is here to listen to John's pitch about why Nike should give its advertising business to the John Brown Agency.
All right, well, let's get to it. What do you have for me, John?
Well, actually, if you don't mind, Phil, I'd like you to start. What can our agency do for Nike?
Well, I'll be honest with you, John. We've got mixed results from our other partners in the past, and the work has had little to no effect. The truth is, I'm dubious that advertising offers any real value at all.
Hey, Phil, we don't say things like that around here. You're not going to get out alive if you do.
I apologize if that sounds blunt, but it's how I feel. When we started up Nike as just an in-house brand, we sold 250,000 pairs. And you know how much we spent on advertising? Nothing. Sales went up 50% the next year, and the money spent on advertising was still zero. We've grown year on year, and we've spent barely anything on ads.
How big's your advertising department now?
A couple of guys. That's it.
And how much product do you sell?
We're on course for $14 million this year.
Well, if you work with us, Phil, I promise you we can beat that number. If you're willing to spend.
But that's the point, right? I mean, why? People are going to buy our shoes anyways. Word of mouth is how we've built this business.
Well, Phil, I think you have to ask yourself this. I mean, what's your end game? Where do you want Nike to be by the time you retire?
Well, I've never been driven by money. Nike doesn't need to be the biggest sports shoe company in the world, or even in America, but I do want Nike to be the best.
Well, there you have it, Phil.
I'm sorry, I don't follow.
That's your reason for advertising. You don't need ads to sell more shoes. They're selling already, right? What you want ads to do is sell the idea that Nike shoes are the best. You're not advertising the product, you're advertising your brand.
In Nike's early years, Phil's past experiences had left him doubtful that advertising was the best way for a growing company like his to use its resources. But after this meeting in Seattle, even Phil had to admit that John Brown made some salient points. So Phil put his skepticism aside and decided to give the John Brown Agency a chance to deliver. Phil's decision to embrace brand advertising would have a profound effect on his business. And in the end, Nike's new direction would lead to the creation of a powerful campaign that would be immortalized with three simple but monumental words: just do it.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery, code Wondery.
If you travel for work, you know to pack two suits, business and swim. You know with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/youknowbusiness.
From Wondery, I'm Lindsey Graham, and this is Business Movers.
Phil Knight may have been skeptical of advertising, but the John Brown Agency made him a believer. Long before the famous Just Do It campaign, the first John Brown-designed Nike ad ran in the December issue of Runner's World magazine.
It showed a bare foot sticking up in the air with a Nike waffle trainer balanced on top. The slogan above read, "Made famous by word of foot advertising." When Phil first saw it, he grinned. John Brown had captured Nike's ethos perfectly. Nike was created for runners by runners, and Nike's most effective form of advertising had always been people who wore the shoes and raved about them to their friends. Phil loved the tip of the hat to Nike's core customers and to the word-of-mouth advertising that had taken his company so far. But moving forward, Phil also understood that Nike would have to incorporate more traditional advertising in its marketing efforts. Over the next year, Nike ran more John Brown-created ads. And instead of selling a specific product, these ads were effective in promoting the Nike brand and creating the idea that running was a sophisticated and stylish pastime. But perhaps no early Nike ad was more successful than the campaign that ran in the spring of 1977. It showed a runner in a bright yellow shirt heading down an empty road surrounded by towering fir trees. Underneath, a slogan read, "There is no finish line." A 19-line manifesto followed, which culminated with the statement, "Beating the competition is relatively easy, but beating yourself is a never-ending commitment." The ad caught the imagination of the nation's runners. Stores ran out of copies of Runner's World for no other reason than runners wanted to cut out the Nike ad and stick it on their wall or fridge. Nike headquarters was flooded with letters from customers praising the ad. They loved the message that the brand was sending. Running was cool. And here to talk about all the ways that Nike has defined cool throughout the years and made billions of dollars doing it is one of the foremost experts on the history of sneakers, journalist and author Nicholas Smith. Here's our conversation. Nicholas Smith, welcome to Business Movers.
Thanks for having me.
So your book is titled Kicks, The Great American Story of Sneakers. I suppose Nike plays a pretty big part in that story.
Yeah, Nike is kind of the 800-pound gorilla in the story of sneakers. They're this titanic force that's the driver of the entire industry, but it wasn't always that way. When Nike began, it was a different company, Adidas, that was that titanic force, and Nike was the tiny giant killer.
Yeah, back then, Phil Knight started Blue Ribbon Sports, not to become a gargantuan global athletic fashion company, but to serve runners with shoes. Now, ultimately, Nike became that very different kind of company. But when do you think Phil Knight first recognized that people were wearing his athletic shoes, built for performance, not to go running, but as a fashion statement?
Well, that all came to a head in the 1970s, and a number of cultural forces were happening around that time, one of which Nike was very, very lucky as a company to kind of ride a wave. And this was, of course, the jogging boom of the 1970s and 1980s. And, you know, as anyone who may have tried running or jogging will know that often the shoes are more comfortable than the activity itself. So suddenly you had a lot of people try this new fitness thing, and then found that, okay, the shoes are comfortable and they do have an element of looking good as well. And as the story goes, Knight was at a shoe industry conference in Chicago in the 1970s. And it's here that he was saying, you know, we're not really in the shoe business per se as the entertainment business.
Well, that's interesting. What did he mean by entertainment rather than fashion?
Well, I think at this time, he recognized that, you know, in order to sell a product, in this case, shoes, whether it's for, you know, an athletic performance or wearing something casually, you have to have a very compelling story behind it. And this is one of the things that Nike throughout its entire history was very, very good at, is getting across what that compelling story was.
So it seems like one of Phil Knight's great superpowers is understanding the story. And in order to do that in the fashion business, you certainly have to have a sense of style, or at least an understanding of the importance of style. Where does you think Phil Knight himself fall in the pantheon of men's fashion, which has some very luminous and different names?
Well, that's a very interesting question because, you know, when we think of Phil Knight as a storyteller, it might surprise some people that his background isn't really in marketing, but it's in accounting. And what Phil Knight was very, very good at is kind of surrounding himself with many, many different people with many different skill sets. So we had, you know, people that were very, very good at marketing, at design, at selling, at the legal aspect. And I think it became clear that the fashion, the casual wear around this time was going to be a big part of Nike's business, not just athletes looking for a very top performance shoe. Now, Phil Knight, you know, has to be credited with being one of the key forces in ushering in a world that we live in today where we can wear sneakers to the office.
So Nike's iconic sneaker designs have certainly become fashion statements. Many are collectibles, and enthusiasts seek out the rare and unique Nike sneakers throughout the world. I guess please discuss the evolution of Nike's sneaker designs over the years. How did they become utilitarian sports performance-oriented footwear and then evolve into collectible fashion statements?
Well, you'll have to look at the sports that Nike was involved in at various points to kind of really see the progress of their design. So, of course, as we've mentioned, they started out as a running shoe company. And if you think of what a typical running shoe might look like in the 1970s, they're kind of a rubber sole, and they've got a nylon top to them. You know, very, you know, fabric-y, bright colors. Bold designs. And, you know, after they kind of outlived their performance usefulness, they became kind of a fashion item as something that you would wear, you know, casually to subtly signal that, okay, I'm, you know, part of this running craze, this running boom. And if we fast forward a couple years, Nike is trying to make inroads into the basketball market. And, you know, it achieved very big popularity with the Air Jordan line of shoes. And to understand what a big deal that is today is people are still paying hundreds and hundreds of dollars to buy Air Jordan shoes that have their design roots in the 1980s. And this is, you know, many years after Michael Jordan himself has stopped playing basketball.
So you mentioned the basketball market and the probably the shoe that Nike is built on, the Air Jordans. This brings up Nike's history of endorsing athletes and sports teams. You've mentioned Michael Jordan, but wonder if you could discuss some other notable athlete endorsements by Nike and how they might have impacted, you know, men's athletic wear.
One of the things that comes to mind is when Tiger Woods first started to becoming a household name in the world of golfing in the 1990s. And if you recall that time, he was almost always seen in a black baseball cap with only a white Nike logo on it. And this kind of minimalism in men's athletic fashion, or as we would call it today, athleisure fashion, kind of saw its roots there. And of course, there were, you know, many other athletes that were key Nike figures throughout the years. Now, in the world of basketball, of course, Kobe Bryant, LeBron James, but also in the world of women's soccer, Mia Hamm probably attest to the fact that she was, at the time, one of the most famous soccer players in America due to that close association with Nike and its branding juggernaut.
You bring up an interesting point here of the kind of the mutual benefit of a endorsement. The endorsee does not only receive a check from Nike, but sometimes they can get Nike's seal of approval.
Yeah, that's correct. And really, this is, you know, not just unique with Nike, but unique with many different companies that rely on that endorsement, is that endorsing figure gives value and lends importance to the brand. So when Michael Jordan, for example, was, you know, one of the very big key endorsers of many, many different products, not just, you know, basketball shoes, but McDonald's, underwear, Gatorade, even Rayovac batteries and hot dogs, it was kind of customers were buying into this galaxy of not just approvals by, you know, the particular product, but approvals by Michael Jordan and wanting to get a little bit closer to that magic, even if you were just buying a pack of batteries.
So Nike has collaborated with plenty of athletes, but not just athletes too. There are designers and celebrities who have also created special edition collections. What are some of the non-athlete collaborators that Nike has brought on board?
Well, in recent years, they've done a lot of work in approaching figures in the music industry and the design industry. One of the ones that comes to mind is rapper Travis Scott. He has a very long list of collaborations with Nike. Now, what's interesting about the shoes that he's had a hand in designing is the Nike swoosh will go in the opposite direction. So if we're used to the fat area being pointed towards the toe, it's being pointed towards the heel. Now, this is a, you know, very small design note, but, you know, instantly when A sneakerhead sees this, they know it is a Travis Scott shoe. And, you know, of course, the value of bringing in somebody outside of the athletic world is you take the people that are, you know, very into sneakers, very into collecting, and also the people that are very into maybe a certain genre of music and bringing those two worlds together.
Now, Nike started out, as we mentioned a couple of times here, as a running shoe company, and Bill Bowerman was instrumental in designing performance shoes. Even though Nike may have, you know, probably grown far out of just a athletic performance shoe company and turned into more of a fashion company, they still put a great emphasis on their technological innovations. So I'm wondering if you could just review some of the materials and methods that Nike is using to stay on the front edge of comfort, functionality, and style.
Well, I'm glad you brought up Bill Bowerman, who's the co-founder of Nike, or co-founder of first Blue Ribbon Sports, along with Phil Knight. And, you know, he was known as a track coach who would, you know, do anything to get any sort of advantage for his athletes. And of course, that extended to building running shoes for each individual athlete. And obviously, you're looking for any sort of technological advantage that might, you know, shave half a second off here or there. And part of the Nike founding myth was, or really founding story, is Bill Bowerman was looking for a type of tread one day for one of his individual running shoes. And he spotted his wife's waffle iron and he thought, oh, well, the tread of a waffle would, you know, fit perfectly with a running shoe because it would grip a variety of surfaces and the rubber would also, you know, act as a secondary grip. You know, if you can imagine running in a very muddy area with a very flat bottomed soft shoe, it's just not going to work. And this, focus on technology, you know, especially in the running and basketball markets for Nike, has been baked into its DNA, you know, so thoroughly that if we look at a particular shoe, we can identify it as a Nike shoe almost without the swoosh. So anyone that has seen an Air Max shoe will know one hallmark is there is a cutaway in the midsole where you can see the air pocket and even poke it with your finger if you want to. So, I mean, if we're talking about, you know, a waffle sole or the Air Max air cushion or even, you know, a technology that's present in running shoes today, a thin carbon fiber plate to kind of act as an additional cushion, they're all part of that that Nike story to get that little bit of edge through technology.
So this is all telling a story of probably what makes Nike great. Nike is not a athletic shoe company. Nike is not a fashion company. Nike is not a technological advanced shoe company. Nike is also a very fashionable shoe company. Nike is not just an endorser of celebrities, but also gives their own celebrity to its endorsees. Nike seems to be a company that does a lot of things well. But one of the things that they do very well is marketing. A journalist for the Financial Times once wrote that, well, I guess he asks, is Nike a marketing company that makes great shoes or a shoe company that makes great ads? Do you think that's a worthwhile question?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, if you're like me, you're probably reading SEC filings on a Friday night. I'm joking, of course. But one very telling thing in Nike's 10K report is when they describe themselves as a business. And I'll just quote right now. Our principal business activity is the design, development, and worldwide marketing and selling of athletic footwear. Now, notice how early in the sentence that word marketing comes from. And it's almost, you know, as critical a component to Nike as the products it's selling itself. It's selling a story. It's selling something that the consumer can buy into and be a part of, not just something that consumers are putting on their body. So yes, you know, Nike is almost better thought as a marketing company that makes fantastic shoes.
If you travel, you know when it comes to love.
See you soon.
Can't wait.
The sky is no limit. You know with your Delta Amex card, being oceans apart means meeting in Aruba. And booking a war travel with your card means saving 15% on Delta flights. You know kissing under the bridge of sighs guarantees eternal love. Because you're the long-distance lovebirds. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Take off 15 discount not applicable to partner operated flights or taxes and fees. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Well, let's take a moment then to remind ourselves of some of the iconic Nike campaigns of the past and how they've influenced marketing in general and fashion.
Well, one of the ones that comes to mind immediately when I think of this, and this is how I open my book, Kicks, is Nike's series of commercials it did with Michael Jordan and director Spike Lee. Now, these were a series of black and white commercials. Lee was playing his character Mars Blockman that appeared in one of his films. And the tagline of these was, "It's got to be the shoes." So Spike Lee was asking Michael Jordan, you know, what makes you so great? Is it your ability to jump? Is it your uniform? Is it, you know, this or that? Or is it the shoes? And what Nike was kind of very subtly telling the people is, you know, if you want to be like Mike, you have to, you know, wear shoes like Mike. And this was tapping into a very old idea, whether unintentionally or not. So if we think of Cinderella, you know, what makes her a princess? It's the glass slipper. If we think of Dorothy getting back from the Land of Oz, it's those ruby slippers. It's a magic shoe that enables you to be something more than what you are. Now, throughout all of its ads, Nike is very key in building storytelling into that brand. And part of that storytelling is also not just, you know, okay, buy our shoe, then you can become a great athlete, but it's that everybody is an athlete. So if you have a body, you're an athlete, as the saying within Nike goes. Another key ad campaign that they did was in the late 1980s. They did a ad spot with the Beatles Revolution playing in the background, and it was a series of black and white vignettes, completely wordless, of just ordinary people exercising alongside Michael Jordan doing a dunk or other professional athletes doing something. And what this was telling you was, you know, with this brand, you're joining the group that has, you know, everyone from your next door neighbor to the greatest sports stars there are. Now, if we want to have a more recent example of Nike's advertising that certainly made headlines, was a couple of years ago, it ran a print ad with former NFL quarterback Colin Kaepernick with a caption in front that says, "Believe in something, even if it means sacrificing everything." And especially at that time when Nike ran that ad, it created not just headlines, but a lot of controversy for the company. And it was kind of an example of the company saying, okay, these are the values that we want to come across to the consumer. And, you know, if you buy our product, you're, you know, buying along into that.
And of course, there's probably the most iconic Nike marketing campaign, maybe the most iconic marketing campaign, period. Just Do It. Do you know anything about the history of that campaign?
Yeah, and this was, when they were looking for a tagline or something to go with the brand. And of course, you know, as most things go in business, these are done at the last minute. And as the story goes, the person within Nike that came up with the tagline was sort of inspired by a murderer on death row whose supposed last words were like, "Let's just do it," or "Let's just get on with it." And obviously, the Nike version is what's remembered more today. And it's kind of been an ad tagline that never really left the company, or probably never really will. And there is that baked in DNA there of the company history that, you know, you can do it. You're an athlete just like the big ones. And a lot of people, you know, wrote into the company afterwards saying just what a great meaning this "Just Do It" slogan was. And one lady even said, "Well, you know, I use that as inspiration to divorce my husband." So, you know, it doesn't really work with only the sports realm. If people were applying it to their everyday life.
Now, for all of Nike's marketing acumen, one thing in their early years that they seemed to not grasp was that the human population of the earth contains men and women. For much of their early years, Nike, maybe perhaps because of their affiliation or their posturing as an athletic shoe company,
marketed to men and became known as a men's fashion brand. But Nike certainly is not exclusively a men's fashion company. In recent years, under CEO John Donahue's leadership, Nike has doubled down on an aggressive marketing approach to women. What are these efforts to expand the brand's appeal to women?
Well, I think you hit on a very good point, both in Nike's history. In the 1980s, they neglected the rise in the fitness boom and the exercise boom, which other brands like Reebok capitalized on. And it really gave Nike a scare and a run for its money. And I think nowadays, they definitely recognize that there is a need to kind of serve not just the 50% of the population that you would think would be interested in athletic shoes, but, you know, absolutely everybody. And if you look at their ads today, there is, you know, just as much of a push on social media as, you know, people playing basketball in a park to women's fitness and women exercising. And I think the most telling thing is, a couple years ago, Saturday Night Live ran a skit where they were showing a bunch of women doing sports and fitness as in a Nike ad. And then, you know, it pivots to, and, you know, our products are very good for, you know, sitting on the couch. And we're introducing the Nike Pro Chiller leggings for if you want to, you know, wear them as pants, pajamas, or use them as a napkin while you're watching TV. So it really kind of goes to show that if somebody is making fun of your efforts, you've done something.
You mentioned earlier Mia Hamm as one prominent female Nike endorsee, and there was Joan Benoit, too, in the early 80s, an accomplished marathon runner. What other collaborations and endorsements has Nike made to appeal more to women?
Well, one of the big ones was when the WNBA was getting off the ground. And, you know, we know the Air Jordan line of shoes. They wanted to create a line of women's basketball shoes built around a basketball player. And this basketball player was Cheryl Swoopes, one of the early stars of the early part of the WNBA. And the Air Swoopes line was one of the very few signature women's sports shoe lines of that time. And it did go through several iterations. I haven't really checked how much these shoes are going for today on the secondary market, but I can imagine it's quite a bit. And, you know, Nike is also sponsoring many, many women's athletes in many, many different sports, running in particular. So they are kind of seeing that, you know, there is a definite value in portraying themselves as a company that's very inclusive and very open to all, which is one of the things that their current CEO is, you know, making sure is one of the key strategies going forward.
So you mentioned Colin Kaepernick, and of course, Nike also has some substantial commitments to environmental sustainability. This points to a company that has values that are probably more progressive than many other companies, certainly. How has Nike's involvement in social issues, you think, influenced fashion trends? How has it been a leader in socially conscious fashion industry, or is the fashion industry itself influencing Nike?
I think it's a bit of both. And, you know, it's very difficult to be a, you know, completely sustainable, completely eco-friendly company when a lot of your products are built in one part of the world and shipped to many other parts of the world. Now, that said, a lot of the big shoe companies, not only Nike, are making inroads into incorporating recycled materials or materials built in sustainable ways into their products. Now, it's a bit too early to see what the real-world impact of that is. But when I was looking into kind of their sustainability and eco issues, I was surprised to find that they're doing this pilot program right now in some stores in Texas and some stores in Atlanta, where you can take in your old Nike shoes and either they'll recycle them for you or they'll refurbish them. And immediately this made me think of, you know, other companies that do something very similar, like Apple Computer. So, you know, if you've taken your old iPhones in, they take those apart and then put them together as a new product for people. But I can't remember if, you know, anyone is really going to want to buy a refurbished Nike shoe, but it definitely shows that, you know, companies are taking notice that this is something that they need to incorporate into their core business moving forward.
I guess to reiterate the last half of my previous question there, fashion has been known throughout the ages as a pretty socially conscious and progressive industry. The colors of Benetton comes to mind, for instance, as an early example. So I wonder, again, is that just an expectation of a fashion company to be a leader in social progressive movements? Or are they influencing themselves? Or is Nike in particular something special?
I think Nike in particular is seeing that there is an opportunity there to be that socially conscious brand. And, you know, it's not exclusive to Nike. Many other companies do this, but it's not, I would say, endemic to fashion to have one sort of outlook on how your business should be perceived versus another. But it's definitely the case that they're, you know, putting a little bit more effort into portraying themselves a certain way. And, you know, Nike's leadership in recent years has set goals that they, you know, aim to achieve a certain level of representation, both in their global workforce and in their leadership of women and racial and ethnic minorities. And part of this might come from, you know, the way Nike was perceived in the past and as a corrective measure. But, you know, this is definitely not something that every single fashion brand is making a point to do.
Yeah, you bring up Nike's efforts to correct perhaps an image of the company that was a bit derogatory. Nike has faced criticism related to gender pay gaps and workplace discrimination. First, I guess, can you remind us of some of these controversies? And then what steps have Nike taken recently to address these issues?
Well, one of the ones that comes to mind, and, you know, my background is in running. It's my hobby. So I'm, you know, very finely tuned to things that are happening in the running world. A couple years ago, there was a big case or several big cases of female runners, professional runners that were sponsored, were saying that they were being discriminated against when they were pregnant and were on maternity leave, not being paid the same as, you know, someone who was still on the Nike books. And when this came to light, it obviously was not a very nice thing for the company that there was kind of this, you know, very big, very gender-based discrimination, especially in, you know, the people that you want your consumers to emulate. So that has since been corrected by the company. If anyone remembers the 1990s and how Nike was perceived, they'll immediately think of the sweatshop controversy. And just to remind people of this, it came out at the time that Nike and several other fashion brands were using very, very cheap labor in Asia and specifically Southeast Asia to make their products. And this, you know, did not go well in front of the consumers. And brands like Nike and The Gap were kind of the poster children of that anti-sweatshop movement. And the company since then has been, you know, much more upfront about where these things are sourced and the conditions that they're made in. So, you know, it just goes to show that, you know, anytime that Nike is the source of, you know, a very big controversy, whether it's sweatshops or gender discrimination or anything like this, they do tend to, you know, want to make steps to better themselves and to improve their public image.
When you choose Organic Valley, not only will you be enjoying great-tasting dairy, you'll help to save over 1,600 small organic family farms who are protecting over 400,000 acres of organic farmland and all the plants and animals that call it home. This is dairy you can feel good about. It's great-tasting, high-quality organic dairy, ethically sourced from small organic family farms. To find Organic Valley Dairy near you, visit ov.coop. That's ov.coop.
In the early days of the company, it was clear that there was a significant culture amongst the core executives of the team. They were all runners or athletes. They all understood Phil Knight's mission and vision and really wanted to participate. That culture of being the best and perhaps, you know, carrying forward some of their athletic, you know, competitive impulses made Nike what it is. Let's turn to today's Nike culture. On the backs of several scandals that you've just mentioned and an increasing awareness and need to market to women, how has a focus on gender diversity and especially inclusivity in its corporate culture influenced, do you think, women's perception of the brand?
Well, I think it's a bit too soon to tell that just yet. Now, That said, Nike has, you know, just clocked record revenues in its latest quarterly earnings and annual reports. So it obviously must be doing a few things right. But that said, these new approaches to, you know, appealing much better to the women's segment of the market, these things obviously take several years before they unfold, and you can kind of see if those strategies are working or not. So we'll have to keep an eye on how that's progressing in order to say, you know, if it's actually a success now or not.
Well, let's pull that back a little wider then to just discuss Nike's future in general. I wonder if you have any predictions on what the coming years have in store for the brand.
Yeah, we can take global soccer as a great example of Nike continuing to make inroads into sports outside of its core of running and basketball. And, you know, in the 1990s, they were the sponsor of the Brazilian soccer team, which at the time you thought, okay, why is this, American shoe company dipping its toes into an area that it really has nothing to do with? But then fast forward, and then we have a Nike team, France, going up against a Adidas team, Argentina, in the latest World Cup final. So, you know, if you're counting how many global national teams are Nike sponsored versus other brands, it's very clear that Nike is going to be a key player, or if not the key player, in the globe's biggest sport. So look for Nike going into, you know, not just the big global sports, but also the tiny ones.
Another thing that Nike is doing, along with most of the rest of the business world, is increasingly shifting its sales strategy to selling direct online. CEO John Donahue has committed to reaching 50% of their business being digital by 2025. And that's just right around the corner. So what do you see Nike doing to reach this goal?
Well, Nike has made a lot of big changes, especially in, you know, how you go about buying shoes. You know, it used to be you would go to a Foot Locker or something in a mall and buy your sneakers from there. Then Nike thought, okay, why have it sold at Foot Locker when we can have it sold by our Nike Town branded stores? And then now we're pivoting to a world that was obviously influenced by the global pandemic, that, you know, people tend not to want to go into a physical place to buy something. So, you know, it's much, much easier to buy something via the Nike website or via something that you see in social media or see in the shops and then order online or have the store order for you and deliver to your house than it has been at any point in the past. Now, and if you think about Nike CEO John Donahue's background, I mean, chairman of PayPal, he ran eBay, so he's really got a beat on e-commerce and not necessarily buying things that are in front of you, but buying things and then getting them later on. So, and I think a great example of a company that is also adapting to a world that has changed. And I certainly see this as the way that, a lot of business is going to unfold over the next couple of years. Because keep in mind, a couple decades ago, we thought, why would anyone buy a book over the internet? And then, you know, here we are.
So let's return to your book, Kicks, The Great American Story of Sneakers. I'm sure you could talk at length for hours on this story, but why don't you give our listeners just a short abbreviated version of the story of sneakers?
Well, what I find most interesting about sneakers, and which I cover in great detail in my book, is they're kind of the one thing that everyone owns. And it doesn't matter if you are spending your entire leisure time collecting sneakers and cataloging them and trying to find the best deals, or if you're just throwing on a comfortable pair when you're going to the grocery store. You know, why is there this one single product out there that appeals to a range of different people for a range of different reasons? And furthermore, how did we get here? So, you know, I trace the beginnings of sneakers from the middle 1800s to when they were, you know, very much tied to leisure activity and who can afford leisure activity, to something that is just so ubiquitous, we often don't think that there used to be a world where, you know, you would never wear this type of shoe outside. And it's a great lens to look at, you know, not just the history of business, but also fashion, technology, advertising, marketing, all kinds of things. Even the history of celebrity is baked into the story of sneakers.
Here's a personal question for you. What brand are you wearing right now?
Well, I'm wearing socks right now, but no, I have sneakers from, you know, all the different brands. I'm, pretty much brand agnostic at this point, but there's something to like from just about everything.
For the sake of equity, I will tell you that I am wearing a pair of Cole Haans, which was purchased by Nike in 1988 and then divested in 2012. So finally, then, this is a business show, and Nike certainly has a lot of business lessons to teach. But for the average business person who won't go on, like Phil Knight, to create a global behemoth multi-billion dollar company, what do you think the lesson is from Nike?
Well, I think it's three lessons. So the first one is, you know, Phil Knight's real superpower was not innovating all of these things on its own. He was really a key scout for talent, and he surrounded himself with people that were very, very good at what they did. Lesson number two, and this is something that Nike's current CEO, John Donahue, has talked about, repeatedly, is his view on leadership isn't so much a rigid military-like hierarchy where general orders come down straight from the top. It's more of a coaching and a team dynamic. You know, everyone succeeds together. Everyone has kind of a different role to play. And it's about that leader kind of bringing the best out of everyone and making sure the whole thing works together. Now, for that third lesson that we see from Nike's history from early days to now, it's about being nimble enough. Even if you're a gigantic company, if there's a problem out there, it's recognizing that maybe sometimes you have to change and change the way that you do business to navigate that problem or navigate the new world that you find yourself in. So, being a coach, surrounding yourself with great people, and being open to change. That's what Nike can teach us.
Well, Nicholas Smith, thank you so much for talking to us today on Business Movers.
Thanks for having me.
That was my conversation with journalist Nicholas Smith, author of Kicks, The Great American Story of Sneakers. You can find him on Twitter at Nicholas K. Smith. From Wondery, this is the final episode of our series on Phil Knight and Nike. On the next season of Business Movers, the famous American banker J.P. Morgan puts his reputation and personal wealth on the line when he intervenes to save Wall Street and the country from a financial meltdown. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Business Movers ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today, or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus and Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey. If you'd like to learn more about Nike, we recommend Shoe Dog, a memoir by the creator of Nike by Phil Knight, and Swoosh, the unauthorized story of Nike and the men who played there by J.B. Strasser and Lori Beckland. This episode contains reenactments and dramatized details. And while in most cases we can't know exactly what was said, all our dramatizations are based on historical research. Business Movers is hosted, edited, and executive produced by me, Lindsey Graham, for Airship. Audio editing by Emily Burke. Sound design by Molly Bach. Music by Lindsey Graham. This episode is produced by Stephen Walters with additional writing by Scott Reeves. Executive producers are Stephen Walters for Airship and Aaron O'Flaherty, Jenny Lauer Beckman, and Marshall Louie for Wondery.
Murder on My Mind, a new podcast available exclusively on Wondery Plus, explores the circumstances leading up to the murder of two young men and the mistrials of the man accused of killing them. Up-and-coming rapper YNW Melly gained notoriety in the hip-hop world for his shocking lyrics and criminal exploits. When two of his best friends were gunned down in a drive-by shooting, investigators suspected the young rapper staged the scene. But after not one, but two trials that ended in hung juries and new evidence that may place YNW Melly at the scene of the crime, his trial has been paused indefinitely. With countless twists and turns, Law and Crime covers all angles of the case and begs the question, is this young artist the victim of a witch hunt or a silver-tongued devil who's evil to the core? Listen to Murder on My Mind exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.